Welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. And this episode is entitled, I guess, Imbibe the Internal Grin. And it's a bad pun on the title of two books by two different authors, but they happen to be married to one another. So this kind of works. And I believe in 90 episodes, this might be the first married couple we've had, maybe, I think. Yes, so the two books are called Imbibe the Air by Judith Alexander Bryce, and the other book is called The Broad Grin of Eternity, poems by Charles W. Bryce. And yes, so they are a husband and wife, poetic double threat, retired physician, retired psychologist. Hello, Charlie and Judy, thank you for being on the podcast. I guess maybe could you give us all a little thumbnail sketch introduction of yourselves?
Well, why don't you go ahead, Judy, since you should be first.
Ladies before gentlemen.
Yes.
Well, you already said I was a doctor, right?
Yes.
I was a psychiatrist for many, many years. And while I was a psychiatrist, my husband approached me since we had a cottage on a lake. And across the lake, they were having a writer's conference. My husband approached me, that would be Charlie, sitting right below me on my screen. And he said, hey, there's a writer's conference. Would you like to go? And I said, but I'm not a writer, you are. And he said, well, you write poetry. And I said, well, no. And he said, well, you write poetry. You wrote some poetry way back. And I said, well, I wrote three poems at the start of medical school. And this was when I was 55. He approached me. Well, he corralled me into this conference, and it was Bear River Writers Conference, a wonderful, wonderful writers conference up in Michigan. And I got hooked. I had a wonderful teacher, Maria Mazziotti Gillan, G-I-L-L-A-N, who resides in New Jersey. Charlie, I can't remember.
Patterson,
New Jersey. And where Allen Ginsberg made his haunt and was from. And I believe William Carlos Williams was from as well.
Right.
Yes,
yep.
And has that wonderful weird book, Patterson.
And so she was my first teacher, and she got me hooked. And I just started writing then. And I retired a little early from practicing as a psychiatrist because I had a bunch of medical problems about which I've written a lot. And I ended up writing, and now I have book three and chapbook one.
Oh, wow.
So I will maybe I can show them on the screen. Will they come through? This is Imbibe the Air.
Imbibe the Air is the new one.
That's book three. And right after that, this book is about to come out. Charge of Shadows, a COVID diary, and it's almost about living with COVID. And so that brings you up to date on me.
Charlie.
Well, I think it's funny that Judy talked about that first conference, the Walloon Writers Conference, it was called. And so I went. I thought I was a fictionaire, you know, I thought I was writing fiction. So we get to that conference, and everybody loves Judy's poems, and they don't not like my fiction. So in the middle of this, there's a little respite. There was a respite for me, and Judy said, well, I'm going to go to a poetry workshop. Why don't you come with me? And I said, well, I don't write poetry. And she said, no, no, go ahead. So actually, I had been writing poetry before I met Judy. You know, this was 48 years ago. And I read the three poems she had written, and I stopped writing poetry for 25 years. I mean, that's, people ask me about the difference between my poetry and Judy's, and I say, well, hers is really good, you know. But anyway, so I went to this workshop with Maria Maziata Gillen, and, you know, I thought I was just going to sit there. She said, everybody has to write a poem, and you have to put a song in it, you know, put one of a familiar song in it. And so I wrote this poem called The Game, and I put Take Me Out to the Ball Game in the middle of it. And about 2 weeks later, it was accepted. It was accepted almost immediately to be published. And it took me a while to get it, but I finally realized I was a poet, and I wasn't a real, although I did publish some stories, but, you know, really, poetry kind of chose me in that sense. So it's been kind of nice. It's been a really good ride. And so this is my fourth book, and I love what you did, Matt. I love that Imbibe the Eternal Grin. I think maybe we'll have a joint poem on there. We'll come up with Imbibe the Eternal Grin. I really like it. But anyway, yeah, I have three other books, and I have been nominated for a Pushcart Prize three times now, and once for the Best of the Net. And I've been published in over 150 venues, and it's been really great. I'm 70 years old. I didn't really start writing until I was about in my 60s. So it's really nice. I'm having a good time.
That's good. And your new one is called The Broad Grin of Eternity.
Yeah.
To make that clear. And I think what's fascinating to me then is, and what both you're saying about how you both, I don't want to say later in life, more recently, right? You lived full adult lives without poetry, and then suddenly now you're poets.
Well, I wouldn't say without poetry, without writing poetry.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, without writing poetry.
Yeah, we always read poetry to each other. Yeah. And we had our favorite poets, and so we were always really aware of poetry, and but then only recently started to write it. In the last 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I think that's important. I think for a lot of people, and I can say as a younger person, not a young person, but a younger person, how many of my friends who had creative aspirations early in life and who then career life got in the way. I mean, my own poetic output got displaced by graduate school scholarship for a decade, I would say. And what does it mean as a great example to folks, even if you're in work and family life, that it'll still be there or that you can find it again? And so the question I have for both of you then, and forgive me if this is too abstract, but do you feel like, you know, as you started writing poetry, as you became poets after taking layoffs or deciding I'm not a poet, I'm a fiction writer, do you feel like as though like that exercises a different part of your brain, or if that does something to the way that you perceive and think about the world? Because I think about this a lot in my own writing, that the things that become poems are what I do with the things I don't forget, and I don't know why I remember them. And that has done something to me and how I see the world and think about the world. And I wonder for both of you if, you know, what has poetics done to you, I guess, and thinking about, I'm gonna write this as a poem, I'm gonna interpret my experience as a poem, that maybe might be different as opposed to other parts of your lives when you were only appreciators of poems, not poets.
I think for me, that's really interesting because as you talk, it's even instructive to me. Poetry is a way of looking at things, and in writing poetry, and so it's learning to look at different memories in a new way, and write them in a new way, and be creative with those memories in ways that you otherwise may have said, "Oh, you remember such and such," but that's it. That, so for me, just listening to you and thinking about it, yes, it's, you go back and remember, and you want to think about things in a different way, in more abstract, more creatively. I don't know about Charlie, but.
Well, I was really enjoying Matt's talk about the interludes, because there is this kind of irritating necessity of making a living, for instance, and poetry just isn't gonna do that. And so we were lucky that we both had our careers as shrinks, and that really made it possible for us to start writing poetry, you know. But to be more specific with your question, I find it's very fascinating to me. I have to fight continually the urge to be reductive, because that's what was productive as a shrink. So, you know, I mean, I'd be sitting there, I was a psychoanalyst, and I would listen to patients discuss their issues and problems. And, you know, our training is, and what helps people is to be able to reduce this stuff down to some themes, you know. That's the project of science, period, is it's a very reductive project. And it works really well in those areas. But in my view, it does not work at all in poetry. Mm. In poetry, you don't want to get down, you know, I think, what is that incredible story about how Ezra Pound took some huge thing of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. Yes, I believe Eliot gave Pound The Wasteland, and Pound got it down to like one 4 or 5 line stanza. I mean, that, you know, you don't want to be doing that kind of thing, right? You know, so it's a real challenge for me, a former shrink, to take ideas, whether they be memories or just more free-flowing poetry, free-flowing words, and not make them just, reduced down to a few principles. So, you know, you want to go the other direction. You want to take those principles and then make them very, very concrete. Give plenty of examples, and then, you know, throw in the poetic language, which is so important, and which my wife does so well. I mean, her language, her poetry is so beautiful and lyrical, and I really enjoy that about her work.
I was going to say, Charlie, I think it comes easier for him to think abstractly outside of the box. Harder for me, perhaps. And that, of course, is the challenge of poetry, is to move outside the box in a creative, abstract way.
Well, yeah, it really helps to be unstable. Yeah, you know. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was thinking last night, so I read both, to prepare for this podcast, I read both Imbibe the Air and The Broad Grin of Eternity last night, back to back.
Wow.
Yes, to prepare for this. Wow. Which, you know, it partially in my head, I imagine maybe a post-COVID Pittsburgh poetry scene that is somehow has this weird tension of like the Charlie people versus the Judith people. Like somehow that'll be the Gulliver's Travels Lilliputian, you know, argument. Like, who are the Charlie? Who's on Team Charlie? Who's on Team Judith? You know. But it's interesting you both say that, though, because one of the things, and yeah, I think the way Judith uses language is incredible. I mean, that's the difference for me, and that's the departure or whatever, you know, is the way. But both of you are, I think, are united, and maybe it's because you live in the same house and have done so for a couple decades now.
I'd say about 4 decades.
About 4 decades now, you've lived in the same house.
But who's counting?
But who's counting? Which leads me to a later question. But the way that you both find meaning and experience in your poetry, I think that's where, that's before the fork in the road in terms of how you both use language, is that you both imbibe. And there's that Kenneth Brooks thing about literariness, and for there to be literariness in poetry or anything, you have to delay meaning.
You have to delay meaning, have literariness,
and to not be reductive and not be direct, which is, you know, and Kenneth Brooks was a New Critic, and in my professional practice, I'm a, you know, theory monster. And so now that I'm teaching creative writing and doing a lot more creative writing myself, it's one of the things I really harp on my students. Like, how do
is
you
the guy, what is this guy's name, Brooks?
I believe it's Kenneth Brooks, and his book is called The Well-Wrought Urn. And he is, you know, for him, he says that in order for something to have a sense of literariness, the difference between text and story and what makes something literature, for him, one of the hallmarks of literariness is that it delays meaning for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
That, and so when you're, Charlie, talking about not being reductive, and it's interesting to me to read both books back to back in an evening, how both of you imbibe or inscribe, I would say, meaning to memory and experience, so that there is this thing that happened to me, there's these scenes to me with your poetry, there's this thing that's going on, and here is the wider meaning of those goings on. You know, I think, Charlie, a lot of your poems talking about individuals and people you remember from memory, and that, not that you psychoanalyze them, but you at least understand the motivation and objective of those people as characters. And I think for Judith, it's, for me, your poems, and Imbibe the Air is just the perfect title for one of your books, thinking about lived experience and having this lyrical sensory experience with your poems that I find fascinating. And we're 20 minutes now into this podcast and neither of you have read a poem yet. And I have my requests, but part of the gig for this podcast is you have a poet on, they read a few poems. And I know, you know, I emailed you before, but is there something one of you feels like reading right now? Or maybe we could go back to back and then reflect on it.
Well, actually, while you were talking, and I do want to read the one you asked me to read. But that was such a nice compliment, actually, because that is what I shoot for. I hope that my own individual experience is going to speak out, you know, to, you know, otherwise it's just an onanistic exercise. So that makes me feel very good that you felt it does. And so it reminded me of a poem I do have here that a lot of people seem to react to, a lot of people our age react to. And, you know, I have in this book, as you know, all these, the truth about poems. Mm. I have no idea really how I started that kind of thing or why really, but, and of course it's the truth about is in some way, sometimes satirical, sometimes cynical, but very rarely literal, although this one comes to, this one that I'm going to read is more literal than others. It's called The Truth About Night. Why is the night so craven? Everything possible during the day seems impossible at night. I'm not referring to the raucous bacchanalia of nightclubs and dance halls, the blockbusters at movie houses or poker nights with the guys. I'm talking about the sweat-soaked, heart-pounding 3 a.m. maelstrom when you're sure you have terminal cancer or infection no antibiotic will cure, or that all your arteries will close at once. This is when your disgraces, every time you measured your mouth for your foot size, reappear in technicolor and surround sound, when the eyes of the world are focused solely on you and people with names like Wolf, Anderson, and Rachel smirk and intone your sins over and over on their 24-hour news programs. You rise from the bed, an anvil of shame on your back. Pee, sip some water, crawl under the covers, and wait for light's subtle shade, that lambent curtain of forgiveness called dawn.
I will say I've thought about the thought passed of stealing The Truth About Device for myself. But yeah, this poem, which I guess if we want to be reductive, let's deconstruct it. To be reductive, it's about that startle in the middle of the night and the decision you got to go pee, taking the sip of water. And that's it. But to infuse and then think about the meaning of that experience in that moment. And that reflects the people, and that, you know, happens to me almost every night.
Yeah. That's almost comforting. Someone as young as yourself, it's almost comforting to hear.
Yeah. So I'm not far, you know, I had an uncle that died when I was in college, and he was 3 years older than I'm going to be this year.
Oh, wow.
When it happened. And that, at 20, that felt like an eternity. But being 3 years shy of that age, no, that's actually not very old.
Well, I know what that's like. My father died at 54. Mm. And my grandfather, his father, died at 54. Wow. So the year I hit 54 was kind of an interesting year. I've outlived them all, but anyway, thank you.
You're welcome. But Judy, would you like to read something?
Well, I kind of, it's ironic because I picked a poem that, in addition to the one that you picked, Matt, I actually picked two. But the one that I picked has to do with night as well.
See, this is, you know, this is the mind meld. This is the interpretive community. This is, you know.
And it's so different as night is from day, Charlie's. So why don't I go ahead and read it, right?
Yes, do it.
So this one is on page 101, if you guys want to follow along.
I do. Thank you. And thank you for letting me know.
I think Charlie's book of mine is down here. But anyways, in the middle, on the verge of bright. Since we're coming up on this time of changing our clocks, it just fits. This is on the verge of bright. Last night, we had no warning, none, about the hours to come, their hands sneaking up to jump the minutes forward, alert us to a change of time, our new season, the days of light, its emerald birdsong, on the brink of bright, on the verge of warm. Last night we forgot to watch the clock, mired we were in cold and drab. That pelt of rain and snow hit hard upon the windows. Our doors shut so brusque and tight that only dark snuck in. Wouldn't remind to set the hour. Think ahead. Think of robins, their trill of shine. Doves, the goldfinches, ready to shed their overcoats, all heavy, burly brown, in wait for lemon sweaters of silk, so honey smooth, so gilded soft.
The other thing about Judith Bryce's poetry, folks, is she can stick a landing. I love how your poems end always. There is always this beautiful language and this meaning in this moment. And again, the way that you capture feeling and lived experience is just so good.
Thanks so very much. It's so hard to come up with an ending always. And you know.
Yeah, I know the feeling, and you know, can be irrationally envious when people can do it and make it work.
Let's do it, but I am very complimented that you think I can.
So then here's then the next question. And I hope I'm not starting anything with this question. But I mean, so you've lived together for 4 decades, you write about the meaning of your memories and the meaning of your experiences. When you read each other's poetry, when you read each other's books, is there this moment that happens as a couple or as an individual or whatever, where you think, oh, I remember when that happened and I didn't know that you were feeling this way? Or even worse, I don't remember it like that. I mean, does that happen? Does that add a layer of, you know, I think about, like, my mom has my book. She's going to read it. You know, she's, you know, it's like that, you know, moment of like, well, that's what I thought about my childhood kind of thing. Do you each have this moment of, or is it like bring you in a way closer together to go, oh, wow, I didn't realize that meant so much to you, or that's what that meant to you. So what does it mean to be a writer couple? Since you're the first writer couple in 90 episodes of the podcast, I have to ask that question. Does that complicate things? Does that make things better?
So I don't have so much trouble like this, like you're talking about, Matt, where I read a poem of Judy's and say, I don't remember it that way. My problem, again, is to fight off the urge to stop writing after I read her poetry, because it's so great. But I do have a poem, now that you mentioned this. I think sometimes I've written things about Judy or about us that Judy kind of wishes I wouldn't have sometimes. And here's one of those poems. I'll read it right now.
Great.
It's called, and then we can hear Judy's reaction.
Maybe I'll stop talking or close the computer or whatever.
That's the end of the podcast.
All right. So this is called Too Muchness. It's on page 21. And it's after Muchness, a poem by Tony Hoagland. Judy and I appear before the Edgewood Borough Council. Petition that august body for a variance to enclose our dilapidated porch. We sit behind a barrier that resembles a communion railing. Listen as the fanatically thin council secretary, her hair so crew cut, glasses so wire rimmed, she could have shot a czar in 1917. This woman reads our petition as if it were a codicil to the Communist Manifesto. The Bryces hereby request the borough of Edgewood for a 5-foot variance so as to enclose a dilapidated porch. Our 400-pound council president road tar hair, double-breasted suit coat, lips that mourn their missing cigar, asks if any witnesses are present. Our neighbor, Pat Doyle, raises his hand. State your testimony, orders Mr. Double-Breasted. I attest, Pat proclaims, that the Bryce's porch is dilapidated. After a whispered conference with Ms. Soviet Union, the portly president wraps his sausage fingers around a tiny gavel and brings it down. Capitalism's local captain proclaims the variance is approved. At which point, my sweet wife flies past me wearing her Jewish basketball referee pants, gold glittered capris streaked with long black stripes. Unbidden addresses the council. Here's what I want to do with the porch, she chortles, and begins, I fear, to talk Mr. Poundage and his shorn revolutionary Porsche out of what they just granted us. They might take the wood out of Edgewood by the time she's done. But the huge man has irrevocably tipped the scales of justice in our favor. And so it came to be that our enclosed porch, lined with stained glass Chagalls, adorned with skylights designed by Judy, today cocoons our home, sunrayed on this wounded edge of love.
Reactions?
Well, you were looking away when I was shaking my head saying, no, I can't hold it. And he goes on and on, describing my attire at the time, which was all wrong. But that is the kind of thing that is so perfect in Charlie's poetry, how he can take a scene and just describe it so beautifully, even though I won't give him credit for how he describes my dress. No, not accurate, not right, but it's wonderful. Mr. Poundage, Miss Soviet Union, I love it. I love it. And I've learned a little tiny bit, and I've incorporated a little tiny bit into my own writing, of that wonderful skill of Charlie's. But it's wonderful, and I've only learned from him a tiny bit of how to do that. The sense of humor, you probably caught a few of my poems or bring that sense of humor in, and I enjoy it. And I'm just learning how to bring in, you know, characters and sense of humor. But that's Charlie through and through, and wonderful.
Absolutely. And I must confess, I thought when you said this, Charlie, it was because there was a poem over here about the first time you two made love. You know, I was like, oh, it's going to be that. But it's the porch. It's the porch that's the third rail. And and so I guess it also begs this question about, you know, I think I ask this of all poets, is that there's poet, I guess there's person, and then there's poetic persona. And does that then maybe complicate or, you know, infuse this question? Because you both have such strong poetic voices. You know, I will say that's one thing. If this were a you know, poetically tense town where there's Team Charlie and Team Judy, you know, the moment of reconciliation is not, this is just a new Bryce poem. Because we would know. We would know who wrote it from that voice. And so I guess for both of you, how do you negotiate that then? Maybe this is another way to think about this question, this difference between person and persona. And yeah, is there a difference?
I'm not understanding your question.
Maybe another way of thinking about it is, you know, there is the personal, intimate lives that we all live. And then there is the poetry that we write and the voice maybe that we use when we write poetry. Mm-hmm. And for some folks, their poetics is about that being the same voice. Like how, I mean, it's the Allen Ginsberg thing, you know, when they asked him what you're going for, he said nakedness. How close can I get to my real self? And I've had other poets on the show. Actually, our mutual friend, actually the person who introduced me to the two of you, Jeanette Schaefer, who talks about her, she has the mother character. It's not her mother, but the mother character. And she has a chapbook coming out soon about her mother poems. And that's a persona and that's a voice. And that's a reinterpretation of experience. And I guess so for both of you, is it about, for when you write poetry, is it about kind of intimately capturing your experiences? Or is it, you know, I'm going to make this thing that's almost maybe adjacent to who I am. And I'm going to write this poem that is a fictionalization or that maybe if not factually correct, emotionally correct about the experiences that inspire these poems. Is that making sense?
Well, it does to me. I mean, I try hard not to, okay, I do a lot of humor, but I agree with Billy Collins that humor is the gateway to the so-called deeper emotions.
Mm.
So, and I agree with Ginsberg too. I mean, I'm glad you brought him up, that the poet always stands naked before the world, you know. And so, no, I try, I think, you know, from us interacting, you know, in our poetry group and stuff that, you know, I use humor a lot in my life.
Yeah.
So no, I want to get away myself. I want to get away from pretension. I'm utterly uninterested in being somebody other than me when I'm reading. And interestingly enough, I would say I had two analyses, you know, one was because I needed it. And another one was because I was in training to be an analyst and it was required. Mm. And I never learned anywhere near as much about myself in those analyses than I have in writing poetry. So no, I've learned so much more about my own struggles and problems and issues and strengths in poetry than I did in analysis. But I don't know what Judy would say here about her own work.
Well, I'm not sure I fully understand what you're getting at, Matt. I would say that all of my poems are, unfortunately, maybe too honest. Mm. You know, I mean, you read the book, so now you know I've struggled a lot with pain.
Yeah.
And put it out there. And it may turn some people off. I'm not sure that it doesn't turn people off, some readers, but that is who I am. And it doesn't, my sense of humor is more restrained than Charlie's in general. It does come out and it comes out more lately, and it does, and I'm learning to present it in my poetry, the poem about Christmas, the Christmas tree, and the poem about Filene's basement, and dyeing my hair when I first found gray hair. And I think I'm very painfully honest in my poetry. And also honest about the things I love. And it's clear I love nature. I love to watch nature. I feel a part of nature, and it's all part of who I am, the good and the bad. And so I'm not sure I'm understanding the question.
No, I think you do. I think you do. I think maybe another way of thinking about it is, as I was prepping right before this for the fiction writers workshop, that I have to teach tomorrow afternoon. And in the chapter of writing fiction about point of view, this question of how, for prose writers, how much distance do you want to have between author and reader?
Mm-hmm.
And how much distance is comfortable between mm-hmm. author and reader? And mm-hmm. I think for writers of poetry, and especially folks who work a lot from personal experience, personal memory, I think that's an interesting, sticky thing that we all have to reconcile with as mm-hmm. as writers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was that. That's the crux of the question. But I think, you know, yeah, this question of being too honest, being too, you know, and so you're someone who is also, if I can say, you know, compromised. And we are in COVID time, which is the best segue I can get, Judy, to talk about your other book.
Mm-hmm.
And that you wanted to read from that book. So you have a chapbook of your COVID experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yes, it's called Shards of Shadows. And is it out yet? Is it?
Is, unfortunately, it's available at the big superstore in the sky, but not, I don't have my copies yet. I'll have my copies in about 2.5 weeks.
Ah, okay.
If people want to wait and get a personally inscribed copy from me, I would be delighted if they made it.
Yes.
Same imbibe the air.
Yes.
And by the way, to answer your question, although that may take away from here, you know, one of the things I thought as you were talking is that I've bookended this book with two poems about imbibing the air.
Mm.
I'm a very serious, meditative, kind of thoughtful, almost doleful poem at the beginning.
Mm.
And another very happy poem, both about imbibing the air. So they're both part of me.
Mm.
So I just wanted to bring that up. So yes, imbibe the air. And I don't know where to, what to read.
That's okay. But it is important that we move units, that we shift units during this podcast. So as you're looking, Judy, I'll say again, if, you know, yes, the big Borg retailer in the sky, you can find their books. But if you email, and I will have this on the website when the website's working, jbricemb@gmail.com or Charlie, charlie.brice@gmail.com. You can arrange an autograph, personal, direct from the poet, delivered one way or another to your doorstep, copy of these books.
Okay, I can read.
All right.
This one I'll read is entitled To My Garden in Time of COVID. Dear friend, I watch you now in gasp of early throes of foam. Yet I see life around, soundless, a pace, laconic, slow. True, you still blaze, glow this start of autumn, even today. But the world has wavered this year, turned far too silent among us all. Your colors have flourished, a kaleidoscope this whole season long, from crocus bud to golden lily and dazzling purple spires of hosta. You've peacocked the panorama, waved your backdrop of fiddleheads, whispers of pampas grass, even my delicate ribbons of pink, which I'm sure have a better name. But for years, my memory has danced with the hummingbirds, too fast, darted away. You've tucked my eyes, burst a new flower each day from a lifeless stem. And our rusty monarch flits for hours. Yet this last week, as summer's close has lowered heat to frost, I think forward towards bitter months to come, wonder, if we've seen our final flash of goldfinch or heard the last lone lilt of oriole, its beckon from afar before frigid, unrepentant months of cold return. I know you'll be a different garden come this spring, marked by new perennials, some weakened flowers dying off. But even so, distraught questions ache my ambling thoughts. Will the monarch still flutter from one garden beyond and to the next? And who will be left to think of milkweed, tend a garden, or have the will to plant?
Yeah, I love that. That reminds me of Glick, Louise Glick. She's got her garden talking to us.
Yeah.
Judy's talking to our garden. And again, I just love the language, you know, and the rusty monarch and the flash of goldfinch and the use of pampas grass.
So, and I love the feeling of, often when we think about that sort of cyclical seasonal time, there is a sense of eternity there. But this very real question, and I think this is something that a lot of people are thinking, feeling, and I think even a lot of young people are thinking and feeling right now. You know, I mean, this very real question of, will the world still exist? You know, which is a very, you know, this, I call the first, at least the first two decades, I guess now we're in the third decade of the 21st century, the long emergency.
Wow. Wow. What a term. Yeah.
Yeah.
Emergency. Wow.
A long emergency. Wow.
Which I think is what we've been living in. And again, I think about, you know, the 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds that I deal with professionally on a day-to-day basis. And yeah, spring is different. Autumn is different.
Mm-hmm.
And winter could be permanent. Or summer could be permanent. You know, that, or not us being permanent, I guess, is that captures, that poem captures that so well in this pandemic anxiety.
Well, since this is about, you know, we're all gonna die, would you like me to read my obituary poem now?
Yes, please. Yes, please. And I think maybe one more poem for both of you, maybe my request poems, and then we'll move on to the bottom five.
All right. Yes, this is this, Matt asked for this. And I think I know why, because Matt has a lot of beautiful poems in his book, The Red Glass Cat.
Oh, thank you for the plug.
He likes to get into philosophy in his work, and I do too. So, and I like that about Matt's work. So this is called The Truth About Obituaries. The one time you absolutely must read the obituary column and you can't because you're dead. You will never read what the amorphous they wrote about you. And no fair writing your own obit. That's cheating. Talk about a conflict of interest. The point of reading your obituary is to see what others thought about you. After all, as Sartre said in rebuke to Heidegger, my death is not only not my own most possibility, it isn't my possibility at all. I'll be dead. No, my death, wrote Sartre, is some other poor sod's possibility. I'm paraphrasing here. Someone other than me will discover my body. Maybe my sweet wife, as she struggles to find warmth in our bed, only to discover the cold hulk that was me. Or some overworked cop called after a neighbor saw too many newspapers bunched on my front porch. Or some luckless EMT who has to pry my broken body out of twisted metal. Will that final scribe highlight my kindness, my fortitude in resisting the government to declare conscientious objection during Vietnam? Or will she focus on my disgust with academia and the ever-dwindling psychoanalytic mirage, my disappointment about growing up in Cheyenne, Wyoming, a dusty, backward, one-horse town that might as well have been in the deep south, with an alcoholic father and a mother who chose an alcoholic man? Will she emphasize how ill-tempered I am after my daily walk? How crabby I get before dinner? Will she find some scandal I'd forgotten or didn't even know about? As I rethink this now, it will be good to be dead when my obit appears. I'm with Sartre. Let the other deal with my demise.
Fantastic, self-aware, and hilarious, and philosophical. And, you know, Heidegger was a Nazi, so forget about
yeah.
him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Heck with him. Yeah,
yeah.
Forget him.
And so, Judy, I wonder if we could close this part of our conversation with the closing, which is the one. I was going to ask for the Filene's Basement one. That was the one I was going to. Can you read that one too? That one's good. You're going to have to buy the book, folks. Buy the book. Find out about Filene's Basement. But
what did you say?
Folks are going to have to buy the book and find out about the world of Filene's Basement.
Filene's Basement has all about the things you can find in Filene's Basement, which is unbelievable what you can find. But you'll never have somebody like Rose who will lead you around Filene's Basement with too much of a lot. Okay.
Yes.
What would you like?
I was wondering if you could do the closing on page 40.
Is this my last one or is there one more?
I think this is the last one because then we got to move on to the bottom five.
Oh, the bottom five. Okay.
Yeah, so we're pushing it. We're going to be over an hour for this one, and that's okay.
Okay. The closing. Outside, autumn has come early, descended with the bronze and carmine leaves that dot the dirt road to our lake house. Our home nearly buried now among cedars and birch, goldenrod and pine. The lake glistens in the wind, catches the slant of sun, its swirls of cloud fleeting and cool in the shifting air as Muggsy trots across the yard, back and forth, then back again in search of the right spot, the ideal site to make her deposit for the morning. My husband and I sit by the quivering fire, lit early for this time of fall, await the call from our realtor. We too go back and forth, then back once more, trying to figure on a right price, the perfect amount that will allow us to bank all our memories of 30 years in a full and single sum. That's it, folks.
That is wonderful. And again, the two books are Imbibe the Air by Judith Alexander Bryce and The Broad Grin of Eternity by Charles W. Bryce. You can get them both, again, the giant retailer thing that you could buy on the internet. And I'll have these links on the website when the website works, jbricemd, jbricemd@gmail.com, and Charlie, charlie.bryce, bryce@gmail.com. And now it's time for the bottom five. The bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. And since you are united as one as a couple, every time I have more than one guest on for the bottom five, you have to agree on your answers. No individual answers. You're a unit. You have to agree and you have to work it out live on a hot mic. Are you ready?
We are ready.
All right. Question one, and this is the question everybody gets first time on the podcast, and hopefully we'll do this again sometime, and you won't get this question, but you got to answer it now. If reincarnation is real, and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
Oh, what about pneumonia, Judy? What would you say? Would that be good? Get into people's lungs. Yeah, they'd try to breathe. They'd fill up with water. Ha, 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 ha. What do you say, sweetie?
No, I'd want to be a kinder infectious disease.
Okay.
Infectious disease, one that just comes once in a while, like, I don't know, some kind of skin disease.
Eczema.
Yeah, but that's
infectious. What about? What about mild to moderate plaque psoriasis?
That's good.
Yeah.
Moderate plaque psoriasis.
We're coming to mild to moderate plaque psoriasis. That's
fantastic.
I knew we were on.
That is a unique answer. You're the only one. Every podcast guest has gotten that question. That we've never had a mild to moderate plaque psoriasis.
See, yeah. There we go. As a doctor, it's not an infectious disease. That's what's catching me up, but I'll go with Charlie anyway.
Okay. All right.
Well, I still want to know, when you went to Harvard Medical School, Judy, did they have a course on kind or mild infectious diseases?
Yeah, there are milder ones.
Oh, God.
On to the next one.
All right. Question two. This will be easier. This is an either or question. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night? If you had to pick one, the total elimination of day or the total elimination of night?
Night. Eliminate night.
Absolutely.
Oh, not night fans. All right.
Bye-bye, night.
All right. This one's a little more open-ended. Question three. Name a film world you would like to visit or live in permanently. And the way I explain this is, you remember in Gumby, the Gumby cartoon, how Gumby could jump into a book and live in the world of that book? Think of that more as a DVD box. If you could jump into a DVD, what film world would you like to either live in or just visit?
Charlie, I'll have a bad time with this. She never remembers movies.
No, I don't. Uh-oh. So it's up to you, Charlie. You choose.
Okay, I would say the whole world of Bogey and Sam Spade. That's where I want to go.
Okay.
The 30s. Yeah. Fast talking, you know.
I like Bogey.
Roll your own.
The production morality code, though. We've been getting this in my film class. The morality code of the late 30s into the 60s, though.
I don't know. I would choose Lauren Bacall. Bogey comes in.
Same thing.
Yeah, same thing. So that era.
Same thing.
Yeah,
same.
So Humphrey Bogart, Logan Bacall, cinematic world.
Okay.
Can get into it.
Okay.
Question four. Is there, and I can ask this question actually finally of a group, more than one person podcast, since you live in the same place. Is there anything in your home that you are afraid of? Is there anything under your roof over there on Maple Avenue that you are afraid of?
Yeah. Our son just informed us. Our son is really very good at construction. He informed us that the reason we have to keep caulking the bathtub in Judy's bathroom.
And the reason it's so difficult to caulk, because it forms a bigger space than usual, is you.
No, you go ahead, Judy.
Well, is that the whole backside of the house is falling down.
Don't tell the realtor or anything, but.
No, I won't, though the internet is forever. Well, actually, we had a family house in Johnstown that leaned so profoundly. I mean, if you put a glass on the table, the kitchen table, you could see that the back of the part of the glass that was faced the back of the house.
Oh, no.
There was a difference between the back of the house and the front of the house, just from the table. And fortunately or unfortunately, an arsonist got my aunt out of that house. Not our choice, actually, but there was a serial arsonist in Johnstown, and almost the entire block that house was on burned up.
Woo.
Yeah, but the whole house was leaning at that point, and yeah. So I would do that. Yeah, I would do that. Well, you know, it's that I have some settling issues in this place myself.
I would like to say that there's no saying that our son is correct. since
there's no saying the sun's correct, but
degree or anything, so he may well be wrong.
Well, how old is the house? When was the house built?
100 years.
Yeah, 100 years. Yeah, things get a little saggy after 100 years. Well, and you know the issue I have with this house is I believe is wood and steel. The steel has not sagged. Mm-hmm. The wood has.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
So, you know, you can if you put a can of soup on a couple of the floors on the upstairs, it'll move around for you. All right. Question five. We're almost through this. We're almost out of this. You're almost safe at home. Question five. And this is the Christopher Hitchens question that everybody gets also on the first time, because when he, in his book Mortality, he talks about when he realized that he was going to die. He said, I really was looking forward to reading the obituaries of Henry Kissinger and Cardinal Ratzinger. And he says, wait a minute, I wanted to write those. So of the living villains of history, with us right now, whose obituary would you most like to write, and the full knowledge that the last four people who were asked this question all said Trump? So Trump's off the board. You got to pick somebody other than Trump. Like, that's been taken care of.
I was thinking Trump already before you finished your
sentence. I know, but as everybody has, so you got to pick something else.
Oh, dear. Well, Charlie, what do you think?
Oh, I think I would pick that horrible physician who kept saying that we should try to get herd immunity and shouldn't inoculate. Who's that a-hole?
Oh, you can swear on this, by the way. So part of the, when you submit an podcast to Apple Podcasts, is if you're explicit and not tagged as explicit, you can, you have two complaints and you get banned for life. So I just keep the tag as explicit, even, so this will come up as explicit, even if there's no swearing. So you're free to not even, you don't have to use the euphemism, Charlie.
All right, that fucking asshole.
There we go.
Who came up, what was that guy's name? It was Atlas, Dr. Atlas.
Yes.
Write his obituary. It'd only be about 3 lines long. What about you, Judy?
Well, I agree with you, since it's got to be an agreement. I think that he really did a lot of damage.
Yeah, he really hurt people.
Yeah, and that's there's like a Faustian angle with that, because, you know, he took the oath, he took the Hippocratic oath.
Oh, yeah.
And didn't. Then you can explore, like, when he turned.
A lot of people took oaths, right? I mean, Judy's been listening to this wonderful podcast, The Oath.
It's great.
By Chuck, what's Chuck's last name?
Rosenberg.
Yeah, Rosenberg. And so he has all these people that took the oath to defend the Constitution, talking about all the people who took the same oath and didn't defend the Constitution.
We're talking about different oaths, though. That's the oath to protect the Constitution.
Right.
What's his name?
Yeah.
But still, that's some Faustian things going on there.
Yep, that's right.
And yeah. So I think that's about it.
Oh, this has been wonderful.
Yes.
Yes, it has. Thank you so much, Matthew. We've enjoyed ourselves.
Absolutely. Thank you for agreeing to do this. And again, there'll be links with the podcast on where to get both Imbibe the Air and The Broad Grin of Eternity, as well as perhaps some other. You could probably email and find out about other books to be. And
Don't forget,
that's right, Shards of Shadows coming soon. Shards of Shadows. And they've written other books. They might have other copies, so you should reach out. So our next episode will eventually happen, and it's going to be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new episodes and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. When it's working, when it's not, sorry if anybody has had some issues. I've had lots of issues. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and I'm going to get better at uploading things to Mixcloud. And eventually, very soon, for our hearing impaired friends, we're going to start posting these podcasts just the audio to these podcasts to YouTube, so that you can read along with the auto-generated captions, which I know aren't perfect, but can be more inclusive. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thank you again to our guests, Charlie and Judith Bryce. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Conversation.
Great.
We had a wonderful time. Thank you very much.
Later, meets.